Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and at 1400 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 28th of June, these are our main stories. The French authorities try to calm tensions following the police shooting of a teenager who later died. In Ukraine, the death toll from a Russian missile attack on a restaurant is rising. And a report says Britain is falling behind on its climate change promises. Also in this podcast.
Under the Korean system, I was 20, but now I get to live one more year as a teenager. It's exciting.
South Korea changes the way it counts people's age. We start in France, where it's more than 24 hours since the shooting dead of a 17-year-old boy in the Parisian suburb of Nanterre. Videos have emerged online of a police officer shooting the boy, who's called Nael, at point-blank range as he was at the wheel of a car. Now, those images appear to run contrary to an earlier statement that the teenager had tried to mow the officer down. President Emmanuel Macron has described it as inexplicable and unforgivable. The Interior Minister has appealed for calm following a night of clashes between police and youths. 31 people have been arrested and 24 police injured during those clashes. Niall's mother has called for a vigil on Thursday for her son.
Join us on Thursday at 2 p.m. for a vigil for my son. Please protest for my son, for Niall. We will all be there. Thank you. Merci.
Mounia Labsi, a local resident in Nanterre, knows Nael's family and went to visit them following the shooting.
You have to know that the mother has got one son. It is her unique son. She was like if she was in a film, you know. She can't believe. And of course, when she realized, she was very sad. But in the same time, she talked with the institutions, the mayor of the town. She said to him, my son is dead, but I don't want anyone dead in these conditions.
Earlier, I spoke to the newsroom's Janat Jalil, who's in Paris.
Well, this police officer is in custody and is facing a homicide investigation. But there is this huge sense of shock and anger right across the country after that disturbing video emerged yesterday. And it shows two helmeted police officers peering into the side window of a car, which is stationary in traffic. And one of them is leaning on the windscreen with what appears to be a gun pointing directly at the 17-year-old in the driver's seat. Then in that video, you see the car starting up, and as it pulls away, you see and hear the gun apparently being fired. And the car continues for a few dozen more meters before crashing into a post. And we know that the teenager died at the scene despite attempts by emergency services to save his life. And as you say, this footage appears to contradict the initial account that was given by police sources. They said that the car was being driven at speed towards the two officers. But in this video, there doesn't seem to be any danger to the police. So this footage went viral. It's led to huge clashes with police overnight in some of the largely immigrant Paris suburbs and in other parts of France. But these suburbs have long had a very troubled history with the French police, and demonstrators threw fireworks and Molotov cocktails at armed officers who responded with tear gas and rubber bullets. And about 40 vehicles were set on fire overnight, public buildings vandalized, more than 30 arrests were made, and more than 20 officers were lightly injured. So it's still a very tense situation, but the authorities are hoping the fact that they were quick to detain this officer and are now investigating him for homicide will help to calm down these tensions.
Well, just looking ahead to tonight briefly, 2,000 extra police are being deployed. Are the authorities worried about more trouble?
Yes, they are extremely worried. The president, Emmanuel Macron, was very keen to express solidarity with the family. He said nothing justified the death of a young person, but he also appealed for calm, saying people should let justice take its course, because the authorities will be worried about The last time there were major riots in France's deprived mainly immigrant suburbs back in 2005, they erupted after two teenagers died when they were electrocuted in an electricity substation after trying to hide there from police who were chasing them. And those riots went on for weeks, but the government is hoping that the fact that they have acted so quickly will mean that won't happen this time. But lawyers for Niall's family are saying other police officers should also be arrested for trying to cover up what happened.
Janat Jalil in Paris. Now, let's go to Sweden, where police in the capital, Stockholm, have allowed a demonstration to go ahead where the organiser plans to burn a Koran. Police have mounted a security operation outside the city's main mosque where the protest is taking place. Just after it started, I spoke to Danny Eberhardt, our Europe regional editor, on what we know so far.
Well, there haven't been any images really showing us a clear idea of how big it is. We think it's actually just a very few people, probably outnumbered by the amount of media and the police that are there. We have seen reports that the person involved, who is said to be an Iraqi refugee, a person called Salman Momika, who billed himself as an atheist, that he has placed bacon on the Quran. We don't know whether that would be viewed as highly offensive by Muslims. We don't know whether an actual burning has taken place at the moment. Sweden is also currently under fire restrictions, so it's an interesting thing happening there. But what we can surmise is that it doesn't take many people to make a provocation that can lead to a much larger reaction elsewhere.
Well, it sounds like it's small in number, but some incendiary acts from what you're describing. Could this cause problems down the line for the Swedish government, for maybe the Swedish police?
It's certainly something that the Swedish authorities are concerned about. The Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, has said that although the act is legal, it's not appropriate. He's warned in the past about how this damages Sweden's image abroad and can lead to problems for Swedish businesses abroad as well. There were protests when there was the last Quran burning in January, which was done actually by a far-right activist, so different field. The problem for Sweden is that it's trying to apply for NATO membership. One of the two countries that's blocking that NATO membership at the moment is Turkey. And the burning of the Quran in January happened outside the Turkish embassy, which enraged the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and caused demonstrations elsewhere in the world, in places like Indonesia and Pakistan. So even if this protest is really very small, it can have, you know, unfortunate consequences.
And just very briefly, have there been any reaction, any kind of counter demonstration that you've seen at all?
We've seen reports that one person has been arrested for trying to throw a stone at the person who's leading this Quran protest. But there's very little at the moment. It is still in progress, so we expect to get more details over the next hour.
Danny Eberhardt. Now, to Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine, where an overnight missile attack on a crowded restaurant has killed at least 10 people and injured dozens more. Twin sisters, aged just 14, are reportedly among the dead. An advisor to the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, Yuri Sak, told the BBC the only way to stop such attacks was to defeat Russia on the battlefield.
They are most of the times targeting civilian objects. They falsely hope that this will break our will, make us more negotiable and agreeable. But this will never happen, because every attack like this only makes Ukrainians more angry and makes our army more determined to continue to liberate our land.
Colin Freeman is a journalist for the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph. He was at the rear lounge bar just minutes before the missile struck.
We were up there just about half an hour ago. They're still sifting through the wreckage. There's quite a few of the staff who are working in the restaurant are there at the scene. They don't want to talk at the moment. I think they're all still pretty traumatised. We saw one guy actually who we think was the guy who actually served us or was about to serve us dinner last night when we just abruptly left the restaurant. But yeah, the rescue workers are still sifting through the scene. I think the sense is that they probably found most of the bodies by now, although it's a big mess of rubble and wreckage, so it's possible they may find one or two more, I suppose. Kramatorsk is one of the towns that's quite close to the front lines in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. So a lot of people have left town over the last sort of 15 months of the war. So it's one of the few places that is still open.
I mean, we've heard that people like you, journalists, are in there. A colleague mentioned some soldiers as well. But look, this is not a military target, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, you get soldiers in practically every dining establishment you could ever go to in Ukraine, whether it's a cafe, a restaurant. Kramatorsk is also a place where soldiers do go for R&R, though, from the front lines, which are, you know, not that far away. It's hardly surprising that this place would have had a few soldiers in.
But, I mean, is there any reason, or do you have any understanding of why Russia may have targeted specifically this restaurant?
I mean, it would have been an open, you know, not, hardly a secret that this place was well frequented by military people and indeed others, civilians, aid workers, journalists, etc., etc. So why they would have targeted it right now as opposed to any time in the last 15 months is hard to say.
Colin Freeman in Kyiv, who was at that restaurant just before the missile strike. Now, how would you like to wake up a year or two younger? Well, if you're South Korean, that's what's happening today, as a new law aligns the nation's traditional method of counting ages with international standards. The old system had been criticised by politicians who argue that it causes confusion and it makes South Korea appear out of step with the rest of the world. Michael Bristow had more from Seoul.
Well, there's three things you have to keep into consideration. The first is the first way they counted their age was by the internationally accepted standard. That's when you're born, you're zero, and you have to wait a full 12 months before you become 1 year old. In South Korea, though, traditionally, babies have been considered to be one immediately they're born. The time in the womb is considered relevant to this. In South Korea as well, there's another factor to be taken into consideration. That's your age increases by one, not on your next birthday, but on the 1st of January, New Year's Day. So it's entirely possible that a baby could be born in the final days of December and at the beginning of the January, being just a few days old, could already find themselves 2 years old. So quite a confusing scenario. And that's what I found on the streets of South Korea. This is what a couple of South Koreans had to say about the change today.
My Korean age is 49. So today I become 48. But when you reach this age, 1 or 3 years doesn't matter. So I'm not ruffled by the change. It's just a number.
I am 19 years old, so I've just become an adult. Under the Korean system, I was 20, but now I get to live one more year as a teenager. It's exciting, although nothing has fundamentally changed.
Michael Bristow with the younger folk on the streets of South Korea. Let's look at artificial intelligence now. We hear a lot about it. It's developing at a rapid rate, with apps like ChatGPT transforming many aspects of modern life. Like those in the rest of the world, businesses and services in Africa are increasingly using AI in their day-to-day operations. Amir Ahmed has been finding out more about the likely future impact of this evolving technology.
Artificial intelligence, commonly referred to as AI, permeates our contemporary existence, heralding an epoch characterized by exponential technological advancement.
ChatGPT wrote that line. I've written the rest, so I'm not out of a job yet. But it goes to show, as one of the fastest growing forms of information technology, AI is all around us now.
Artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence has been in the news a lot lately.
In Africa, over 2,400 AI organizations are now operating across multiple sectors.
Has AI come to take people's jobs? Yes, AI will take jobs. Technology and advancement doesn't just take jobs. What it does is refine jobs.
That's Nawa Chinimeri Emeka, the founder of Kitavu, an agriculture AI app designed in Nigeria which processes datasets on soil quality, satellite imagery, and market demand to provide farmers with crop health audits and recommendations.
It's able to recommend what type of fertilizer to use. It's really a game changer for smallholder farmers on the continent.
With erratic electricity supply and only 22% internet connectivity across Africa, according to the International Finance Corporation, how accessible is artificial intelligence?
The difficulty is in South Africa is that not everybody has access to electricity security.
Dr. Linda Meyer is the head of operations at the Independent Institute of Education in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Certainly there are huge impediments around all of those areas, economic security, around electricity security, social and economic divides. It's going to be a much slower process for Africa to catch up.
Most AI voice recognition systems are built with algorithms trained by natural language samples from English-speaking countries, which means many don't understand African dialects or accents. Toby Olatunji is the founder of Intron Health in California, a speech-to-text app software that helps doctors dictate their notes. It's currently active in 5 African countries and supports over 200 African accents.
We're able to help doctors complete their notes about 6 times faster on average. If people are able to see the doctor quicker, they get help faster. The first thing is to always remember that it is AI and it is not perfect. You have to go back and review it, because if you don't do that, the doctor could get into trouble. If you said, administer 300 milligrams and the software says 3,000 or 30, then you're going to jail.
With all the promise of AI, it also has its risks, which needs to be mitigated, like large-scale disinformation, deep fakes, and the potential to be used by cyber attacks. It's important to remember that AI cannot operate independently of humans. What we get out of it depends on what we put in, and what really matters is how we use this new tool.
Amir Ahmed reporting. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. Have you ever heard an orangutan beatbox? Of course you have. Well, we'll have more on their talents.
Every weekday morning, wake up with an in-depth look at a single story that's affecting Africa right now.
And every weekday afternoon, wind down with 3 essential stories from across the continent and hear African perspectives on global news.
That's what you'll get from Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
2 BBC World Service podcasts all about Africa.
And where will they find them, Alan?
Just search for Africa Daily and Focus on Africa wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. The leader of the failed Wagner rebellion, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is thought to be in Belarus. He's agreed to leave Russia after calling off his mercenaries on Saturday. President Gitanas Nausėda of Lithuania, which borders Belarus, said the fighters were dangerous as they could take part in sabotage and infiltration operations.
Last Saturday, we all have seen the mutiny of the Wagner group in Russia. If Wagner deploys its serial killers in Belarus, all neighboring countries face even greater danger of instability. Under such circumstances, deterrence and forward defense is a top priority.
Well, the Lithuanian president is due to meet his Ukraine counterpart in Kyiv today. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, joined us from Warsaw. So is Yevgeny Prigozhin still in Belarus?
I should say we're not entirely sure that he's still in Belarus. Like so much in this whole crisis of the past few days, there are some things that are pretty hard to pin down. Certainly we know he landed in Belarus yesterday morning. We know that the president of Belarus, Lukashenko, had confirmed that he was in the country. But the group that had tracked his plane or a plane linked to Prigozhin landing yesterday morning also tracked it leaving Belarus late last night in the direction of Russia. So a mysterious moment again. I would say that Alexander Lukashenko made it clear when he was speaking yesterday that Wagner forces had not yet arrived. So there wasn't like a kind of crossing en masse of fighters linked to the Wagner group into Belarus. So I think really what we're seeing is the kind of thrashing out of the actual details of this deal that was done at high speed as those mercenaries march towards Moscow. So there's a lot that still remains to be agreed upon, I think. Obviously, we'll have to keep an eye on it. But for now, we don't believe the mercenaries, you know, the Wagner group as a whole, has actually moved yet to Belarus or even possibly Prigozhin himself.
Sarah Rainsford. Here in the UK, the actor and director Kevin Spacey is appearing in court in London facing 12 sex offence charges. The Hollywood star denies allegations of historic offences committed against 4 men. which is said to have taken place between 2001 and 2013. Joe Inwood has been at court for us.
Already we've got dozens of journalists here for what is going to be a very, very closely watched case. Of course, Kevin Spacey, one of the biggest names in cinema, he came to prominence in the film Glengarry Glen Ross and then had a number of incredibly successful films, The Usual Suspects, and of course American Beauty, for which he won the Best Actor Oscar. He was also the artistic director at the Old Vic in London here for many years, and it is events that took place here in London and in Gloucestershire that are going to be under investigation at Southwark Crown Court today. Now, Kevin Spacey will be appearing here under his true name, Kevin Spacey Fowler, and he faces 3 charges of indecent assault, 7 of sexual assault, and 2 of sexual activity without consent. Now, the alleged offences took place between 2001 and 2013, and again were allegedly against 4 men who are now in their 30s and 40s. Now, we should say that Kevin Spacey denies all the charges, and the trial is expected to last 3 to 4 weeks.
Joe Inwood. Let's stay in the UK. When Britain hosted the big international climate summit known as COP26 2 years ago, the government here wanted to portray itself as leading the way when it came to cutting carbon emissions. Now, though, its own advisers say the UK is falling behind. In a highly critical report, the Climate Change Committee, which is an independent body, says targets are being missed on nearly every front, making it less likely the country will be net zero on emissions by 2050, which it is aiming for. The outgoing chair of the committee is the former Conservative Minister John Gummer. He spoke to my colleague James Menendez on what Britain is getting wrong.
In COP26 in Glasgow, we led the world. But unfortunately, since then, we have gone backwards in our delivery against those standards. And at the present pace, we will not meet what we have promised. We have agreed to do things which run wholly against what we need to do. Like we've agreed a new coal mine, 85% of whose coal will be exported and probably used for generating electricity, which is what we say we shouldn't do. And so we are going backwards in the sense that we're not delivering. And we're also going backwards in the sense that we're not standing up for the standards which we have previously put forward for the world.
And on that second point, does that undermine Britain's moral authority when the UK wants to try and encourage other countries, particularly in the developing world, to make the switch to renewables?
Well, of course. I mean, here we are, pledging money to get people to move to renewables. But if we go and exploit new oil and new coal ourselves, why shouldn't they do it?
I mean, in response to the report, a spokesperson for the government said that Britain was going far beyond other countries, and in fact, that the UK was cutting emissions faster than any other G7 country. Is that not right then?
That's about the past. That is what we have done. What we're talking about is we are committed to doing things in the future, and we are not delivering on that as we have in the past.
And how do you explain this then? Is it a lack of political will, do you think?
Well, I think it's a lack of leadership. One can't blame the Prime Minister. He's only been around for a bit. But the fact of the matter is it's a lack of leadership. And we need leadership which says to people very simply, we either do these things now or it will be enormously more expensive. And even more important than that, the kind of climate which we are creating will be unlivable in for many people. And if you think that the boat's problem of migrants now is very big, it'll be hugely greater when we have people moving from countries where they can no longer live, which is what is happening if you allow the temperatures to rise at the pace they are now rising.
John Gummer speaking to James Menendez. Now, let's stay on climate change, but we're going to move to Iraq. That country is a major oil producer, but its president has told the BBC the government is serious about combating climate change and water shortages. President Abdul Latif Rashid was speaking in his first English-language TV interview since taking office in October, which he gave to my colleague at the BBC, Mariam Mashiri. I asked her how serious he was about tackling climate change.
Drought issues have increased in Iraq in recent years, and it's now, according to the UN, one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change. The drought's mainly been caused by rising temperatures, by climate change, but it's also been exacerbated by a lack of investment, to be honest, by the government in infrastructure. Now, remember, Iraq has not been a stable country for a very long time. And the current relative stability, which has brought some measure of peace to a degree, has given the government a chance to really address some of these serious issues. Water scarcity has displaced thousands and thousands of people. So the president admitted to me that the issue is a difficult one and that Iraq has plans to tackle it.
We have taken serious actions regarding improvement of our water system and at the same time dialogue with our neighboring countries. And the most important factor is to improve our water system in Iraq. I think we are taking very serious actions, but I agree with you. We suffered under the climate change. We suffered under shortage of water. And the basic reason for not tackling these problems was we suffered from the terror attacks and conflicts in Iraq for a long period of time. But the government's program is very clear, and we are taking a serious decisions and serious actions.
The president not really giving a lot of detail on precise plans, but we do know that the Iraqi Minister for Water has said that Iraq is seeking joint projects with Iran, including potentially construction of a dam on the Arvand River to address water-related problems. And the Prime Minister al-Sudani has also said his government has drawn out a climate strategy that extends to 2030, which includes trying to incentivize farmers to use modern irrigation technology and also harness renewable energy.
Iraq remains a prominent and important oil-producing country. Did he address that at all?
Well, Robin, absolutely. Iraq is a very prominent oil-producing country. A lot of its economic stability, if you can call it that, comes from oil revenue. I did ask him about the worries that the IMF has about that economic stability, because, of course, Iraq relies heavily on oil revenue, too heavily, according to the IMF. But it's trying to convince foreign investors now that the economy is in hand and that tighter fiscal policy could potentially be brought forward. So I think very much that one of the reasons why the president wanted to give this exclusive English language interview to the BBC was to make sure that the message gets out there that Iraq is open to other forms of foreign investment, that this is a period of relative peace, and that Iraq very much is open for business.
Mariam Mashiri, and you can see her full interview in The Context on BBC News at 1800 GMT. OK, you ready for the orangutans? Have a close listen to this. That was an orangutan performing the unusual trick of making two separate sounds at the same time. Songbirds do it, and people use vocal percussion involving the mouth, lips, tongue and voice in beatboxing. Scientists have observed the phenomena in two populations of the primates, in Borneo and Sumatra. They believe it may provide clues on the evolution of our speech, human speech. Dr. Adriano Lemira from the University of Warwick in central England is one of the lead authors of the study.
Their vocal repertoires are composed by consonant-like and vowel-like calls in like manner to each and every spoken language. So this, of course, was already a very positive indication that what great apes do vocally is very closely related to what humans do verbally. They were producing consonant-like calls at the same time as vowel-like calls. So the best way of imagining this is to understand that consonants typically come from the mouth, like the speech sounds p, t, k, s, which are the result of lip and tongue and jaw movement, whereas vowels typically come from our larynx, from our vocal folds, from our voice. And so because consonants and vowels have these different sources in the vocal tract, it's possible to produce certain combination of the two simultaneously. This, of course, is very difficult to achieve, even for us. Typically is better observed in people who have really gone through dedicated and extensive training to expand their vocal capacity, such as beatboxers. We suspect that they are producing something that is extremely complex and difficult to do vocally as a signal of vigor and fitness. In Borneo, we observed males producing these sounds in pre-combat situations, which is not too distinct from how beatboxers battle. In Sumatra, females were producing these sounds towards potential predators, which again could signal vigor to dissuade an attack.
That was Dr. Adriano Lemira from the University of Warwick. And that's all from us now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. Please tell us what you think. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop and the producer was Phoebe Hobson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until the next time, thank you and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Clara Graham.
And I'm the BBC World Affairs editor, John Simpson.
And we'd like to tell you about a new podcast from the BBC World Service, The Explanation.
The Explanation looks beyond the headlines, bringing you in-depth analysis of the stories affecting our lives.
Whether it's important, long-running issues,
or the latest global events.
We're making sense of the big stories.
And giving you an honest, unvarnished explanation of the world.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.